All right, welcome. You're listening and tuned in to KPTZ Port Townsend. This is Critical Conversations. My name is Robert Ambrose, and my co-host is Dar Jamail.
Great to be with you, Robert. This week, we're going to do something a little different than our usual method. Instead of including a COVID and climate crisis update, we're going to jump straight into the deep domestic politics of the day. And given that we're on the heels of the impeachment trial and then the acquittal, I could think of no better person to talk about this than William Rivers Pitt. He's a former colleague of mine at Truthout when I used to work there, and Will is still writing for them. Will is a senior editor and lead columnist there. He's also a New York Times and internationally best-selling author of three books: War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, The Greatest Sedition is Silence, and House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. His fourth book, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible, was co-written with yours truly. Will lives and works in New Hampshire, where he is joining us today, and his most recent op-ed for Truthout about this political crisis that we're in is titled "Trump and McConnell Do Battle as GOP Civil War Heats Up." So, Will, welcome to the show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And it's a real honor to have you on as officially our first guest. We're very proud to come out strong. So here we are. It's not that long after the conclusion of the very speedy impeachment trial. And Will, you've been extremely critical of how the Dems have handled this and botched it and their lack of having the opportunity to call witnesses and drag this thing out and really getting it down into historical record, even if it wasn't able to prevent the acquittal that happened. But that failure of the Dems to handle this the right way, yet again, against the backdrop of a now overtly fascistic and anti-democratic Republican Party, what does this failure tell us about the Democrats today?
There's a saying that I came to live by over the long 5 years of the Trump mayhem, which was, so many times you find yourself in a situation where you're utterly astonished and not at all surprised at the same time. There was quite a lot of talk in the mainstream press after the end of this latest impeachment debacle about how it was a moral victory and how getting seven Republicans to vote to impeach was an incredibly big deal, and history will record this and history will record that. And it's balderdash for a number of reasons. First of all, the Democrats have perfected the art of forgetting that they have power when they have it. Now, granted, it is a slim majority in the House and it's an even slimmer majority in the Senate, but it is still a majority. Mm-hmm. And the thing that Majority Leader Chuck Schumer did was give away witnesses to Minority Leader McConnell to get this thing over with quickly, because everybody knows that these lockstep Republicans are going to vote to acquit no matter what. They had cleaved themselves to this fiction that the whole thing was unconstitutional, and that was going to be the fig leaf that floated them down the river. And because they're not going to do anything, the idea that a long and detailed hearing about the facts of one of the darkest days in the history of this country should be let by the board simply because you don't think you have the votes, that's not the point. The Benghazi hearings, they never had the votes, and they went on for years. The Butler emails hearings, they never had the votes. They went on for years, and those were nothing investigations. They were investigations to say the words Hillary Clinton and fraud as many times as possible to make fertile the ground for the 2016 election. And by the way, it was brutally effective, as we have all come to see in the aftermath. These Democrats cannot seem to understand that Dar, it's funny. The one thing that I have that I've absolutely stolen from you, Dar, is the argument you make towards the end of your book that hope is no longer about what the results are, that hope is about the effort yielding its own rewards. Nothing could underscore that more than knowing you don't have the votes, to convict in the Senate and still putting on witnesses and still putting on the kind of presentation that would have let everybody know exactly what these people were up to the decimal point. Everybody deserved to know that. The final aggravation in the whole thing is they won. They won. No, I would have lost a bet. But all of a sudden, five senators pop up, including the Lindsey Graham, pop up and say, we will vote to hear witnesses. And all of a sudden, we're off to the races. And I'm bouncing around the room. And 3 hours later, it's over with no witnesses called. I mean, it's one thing to get beat because you didn't suit up. It's another thing to win and quit.
But isn't that life as normal, the Democratic Party, for the last decades?
Decades, 50 years, ever since the collapse of the labor minority, you name it, coalition, and the rise of Reagan and the Lee Atwaters of the world, knowing how to pull all the levers and push all the buttons and raise all the money. And people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have been on their knees to these people for the term of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in the year 2021. We have chased this demon out of the White House against all odds. They had no hope whatsoever that we were going to win, that the Democrats were going to win that election. None whatsoever. I had no reason to hope. And we almost lost. You know how much you won by? 44,000 votes. In the places that matter, where the Electoral College turned, won by 44,000 votes. That was rather eye-opening. Forget the 74 million people who voted for the guy. The 44,000 vote margin. You can't slip a needle through that. They had an opportunity to explain to people in absolutely deserved detail what happened that day, what happened when he went back to the White House, what happened in the tent before the thing started, what happened in the building. The video was fantastic. You know, I'm the MTV generation. I like a good video as much as the next guy, but it's not an eyewitness who got his head cracked open by a pole. It's not someone who was in the Oval Office when the president of the United States was refusing to call for help because he was enjoying the show too much. You know, everyone sitting in this conversation has had our gut punches over the last 20, 30, 40 years. And that was as bleak a moment as I can remember.
And in historical context for this, Will, this is what really gives me pause. And I'd like for you to comment on this. In 1923, Hitler attempted a coup which failed. No one was brought to account for it. 11 years later, he took power, and we all know the atrocities of this story. Mark Twain has written, as you've quoted in your column, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. Talk about what are your deepest concerns about this lack of justice in this recent impeachment.
I tend to blanch at the Hitler comparisons because of, you know, Godwin's law. It's a internet rule from way back in the Unix days that says on a long enough timeline, any argument is inevitably going to have somebody summon Hitler as part of their argument, and that person automatically loses the argument. So that having been said, it's not a lost metaphor. I think it's important to 1923, you know, it's 2021. The seeds that were planted over the course of the last 5 years are going to take quite a bit, just as the seeds that were planted in the 90s during the rise of the first real militia wave mm-hmm. are now, you know, coming very much to bloom in much darker and more violent ways after 30 years of flooding the country with war weapons. You know, it's bad enough you have these big people who want to turn the place into a white power paradise. There are more guns than people in this country.
And now there are new news reports that the Proud Boys, et cetera, are planning something on March 4th.
March 4th. I have only so much RAM in my head for this stuff with everything else going on. So I kind of have March 4th up on a shelf here. At some point, I'm going to figure out the significance of that date. But I cannot for the life of me figure out what constitutional or legal or presidential or congressional import hangs on that day.
Right. So
it's good that people are talking about it already, because there are a lot of people whistled past the graveyard on the 6th of January. And there were a lot of people, I think, who helped. Mm-hmm. I've been watching, and I mean, I say this full in the knowledge that a great many of the Capitol police officers who were involved in that fracas who got really badly hurt and scared, and two of them have taken their own lives, and one of them was beaten to death with a fire extinguisher under the Capitol dome, even though he was a Trump supporter too. All of this is fact and cannot be taken away. But with my own functioning eyes, I saw Capitol Police moving barriers and taking selfies with the people who were running riot through the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why that building fell as quickly as it did.
Yeah, many reasons.
And the idea that these people have already telegraphed March 4th as the next big thing gives the people within law enforcement who actually care about their oath an opportunity to prepare and to sound the alarm if it seems like there's people in the upper echelons, like the sergeant-at-arms of the House and the sergeant-at-arms of the Senate, who refused to call for the National Guard, who resigned immediately after that all ended, getting out ahead of any reluctance those people may have to stand up against the kind of tide that's coming. This is the new way of things now. It was an extraordinary victory for the far right in this country, the sacking of the Capitol. It was they pulled off what Robert E. Lee never could.
In segueing off of that, Will, since leaving office, you know, Trump recently called McConnell, as you quoted in your piece, quote, a dour, sullen, and unsmiling hack. Talk about how you see this civil war within the Republican Party playing out.
I see Trump winning it ultimately. My instinct is I'm like the guy from the Godzilla movie. Let them fight, because let them do damage. Nothing, never interfere with a perfectly good train wreck. I think that Donald Trump and the people in his inner circle have been fooling a lot of people for a long time. You can hide behind the idea of being a buffoon, except all of a sudden, here I am in charge of this political party that is in total disarray because of me. I think you're going to watch the next 2 years. Is going to be him trying to consolidate his power. And it may cost them the next round of the midterms. Again, you mentioned 1923. The tanks didn't roll in Poland built until 1939. It's a long game.
Do you think there'll be a separatist party, or do you think that more moderate Republicans will? They'll certainly stick to the Republican name, won't they?
I loathe and detest the term moderate Republican. There's no such ED thing. They surrendered, speaking ill of the dead, they surrendered that right when they embraced Rush Limbaugh back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. That guy finally shuffling loose the mortal coil is going to be a very interesting Rorschach blot for the right in general, because he was as on board with the Trump program as anybody out there.
Even helped create it.
As Charles Piercer Esquire said, he was feeding the disease before anybody knew it had a name. One of the great blights.
But Will, don't you think, you know, given the vote that we just saw in the trial, that what is it? So basically 43 Republican senators are, you know, lock, stock and barrel, you know, full on in the Trump party now. 43.
I'm not sure that that's true. And this is hearsay. But there has always been, going all the way back to the first impeachment, talk was that they would have removed him the first time if they could do secret ballots. For the Louis Gohmerts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens, this is the golden age. I think for quite a lot of these people, and it's their own fault, but the Republican Party has turned into a hostage situation. Because what you have to understand what you're dealing with here. We have a tendency in the media to look at things from a top-down perspective. What's going on up here is the most important part. It's not true. The state-level Republican Party apparatus in every major Republican state, deliberately, this was the Tea Party. It's mm-hmm. all the same
thing. Yes.
The Gingrich revolutionaries in the 90s turned into the George W. Bush diehards in the aughts, turned into the Tea Party, turned into the Trump people. It's the same people. They just buy new T-shirts. But it's the same section of the Republican Party. And they got smart 30 years ago and took over the local branches of their various Republican Party apparatus. And these guys up in Washington are looking, you know, every time the phone rings, they're like, oh my God, what do we do? Almost every one of the Republican House members and senators who voted to impeach or voted to convict already has a primary. Mm-hmm. And it has been censured by their local government. People are protesting their houses because at the ground level, Donald Trump has these people by the throat. And it's at the ground level that these lifelong career politicians have to live. They got to go back to those districts and rely on that infrastructure to raise money and get out the vote. And if those people, and if they're not, if they're not sufficiently Trump loyal, they'll get tossed aside. At a minimum, these people, that apparatus will sit on their hands. At worst, what Trump has promised to do is to start shotgunning primary challengers out there left and right. He's got $300 million that he fleeced from these people while he was challenging the vote, challenging the election. He's in a real kingmaker position.
So at the risk of asking an oversimplified question, I mean, so it sounds like you see this as really potentially the disintegration of what's left of the GOP versus an effective consolidation of power to take it, you know, even further to the right, where all these folks are essentially minions of whoever's pulling Trump's strings.
The best case scenario that I can play out is that the Republican Party fractures on like a 60-40, 70-30 level. 70% goes to Trump, 30% are the Lincoln Project type people, each of whom will fall back on their own donor bases and fall back on their own geographic. And the Lincoln Project, you know, quote unquote moderates, barf, 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 will wind up having to fall back to the coasts, to the more traditional liberal progressive bastions, because the center of the country is gone for them. It's just gone.
And then I have to ask, what's your worst case scenario?
My worst case scenario is that my humblest forgiveness to my humblest request for forgiveness for this really terrible analogy, because it's not accurate, but if that 70-30 break turns into a Sinn Féin IRA type of thing, where you've got a legitimate political party trying to do legitimate political party things while the gunners are out blowing things up and shooting people. I could go chapter and verse about how the IRA had a point and all the rest of it. So it's a bad analogy, but on the molecular level, in terms of you have a political party with an armed wing to it that is liable to pop up and do anything. The Basques, I mean, there are plenty of examples of do what we say or something's going to blow up. Mm-hmm. And if that, the worst case scenario is that that becomes a normal part of the conversation politically in this country. Going to a poll, going to vote becomes a perilous thing. After September 11th, we were all walking around like, ooh, that's a big crowd. That's a big target. I don't want to do that. With COVID, I see a big crowd. Oh, that's a big target. I don't want to do that. Oh, here comes, you know, the PLO version of the Republican Party going to blow something up if they don't like what's transpiring. And all of those are insulting comparisons, but I'm talking about a militant armed wing of an American political party active in the country. This is an absolutely perfect historical analogy, like Jubal Early and his people riding up and down the Shenandoah Valley during the Civil War, hitting and running, and no one able to stop them and no one able to catch them because they can disappear like smoke.
And that's what January 6th was really exactly that, wasn't it?
Nobody saw it coming. They came up the Shenandoah Valley and pounced.
And the militaristic flank.
They were advertising it on the goddamn internet.
Right. As they're doing again.
I've been working to really kind of push the idea that these people are Confederates. There's an argument to be made that the Civil War never really ended. And wow. More to the point that the North has been losing it for the last 30 or 40 years. To see those Confederate flags weren't there by accident. That wasn't just for style points.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. This goes right back to before the Civil War. This is white supremacists who are losing the population position that they've had. It's going to be a minority majority country soon, if it isn't already. And so their power is threatened.
It's amazing. It's amazing what happens when you ask people to share.
Yeah.
One other thing, Will, you're one of very, very few writers on the broader left in this country now, and have been for years, who has been point blank in talking about Trump's direct ties to Russia. So I want to I'm real curious to hear why you think there isn't more talk about this when all the facts are and have been on the table. Why are more folks not addressing this, especially on the left?
There's an old saying, Hunter S. Thompson said, I'm trying to remember exactly what the quote is, but when everyone's a criminal, the only real crime is getting caught. I think after the Citizens United decisions and the ones that followed afterwards, and the floodgates of the darkest of the dark money opened, I think that there are a lot of politicians in Washington, D.C. who are taking money from addresses on the Volga River. Because that's not paranoid. If I'm the Russians, that's just smart. You are opening your political system up to influence from the outside. Okay, here's some influence from the outside. Mm-hmm. Now I want you to vote this way on Ukraine. I want you to vote this way on the pipeline. And then all of a sudden, Trump comes blundering in with his ham-fisted Russians screwing around, and it's going to make everybody look bad. I don't think there's no great, usual suspects, Kaiser Soze plot here. It's the money. There's so much foreign money flooding American politics right now. Nobody wants to talk about it. Everybody's guilty, so nobody's to blame. Mm-hmm. You can get down to the grand thing. Why did nothing come of the Mueller report and all the rest of it? Because Robert Mueller soft-pedaled the whole thing, because the Democrats didn't have a toehold on any portion of Congress at that point to really pressure it. But I don't think there was a great deal of enthusiasm to go chasing that particular hare. It was complicated. It was confusing to some people. A lot of people seem to get out there with the idea that anyone, I take grief to this day from friends of mine about, well, don't you feel dumb about saying all this Russian stuff? Don't you understand they're just trying to start a new Cold War? Like the idea that this massive pile of information about dealings between the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration and the Russians is all just a big Pentagon smokescreen to try to start another Cold War. The Cold War's already kind of started. You know, mm-hmm. we're here and we're losing and whatever. That's irrelevant to the entire conversation. But I don't think that until the Aegean stables are cleaned out in Washington, D.C., and until we throw a rope around how we finance politics in this country, it's only going to get worse. I think China has an equal footprint mm-hmm. in America. I mean, you saw what happened with the NBA last year. Somebody was critical of China, and all of a sudden, like, basketball almost stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
these aren't small things. This country is an advertisement, and it's a business. And the American dream is a business arrangement. There's no morality to it whatsoever.
If we can get back to Trump for a minute, there are all kinds of lawsuits that are pending in New York. There's a congressman that now has filed suit against Trump and some other people because of the January 6th insurrection. Do you think that all these lawsuits may hobble Trump and diminish the potential for his movement?
I will read to you the first paragraph of an article from the New York Times that I read just before jumping on with you guys. As the Manhattan District Attorney's Office steps up the criminal investigation of Donald Trump, it has reached outside its ranks to enlist a prominent former federal prosecutor to help scrutinize financial dealings of the former president's company. The former prosecutor, Mark Pomerantz, has deep experience investigating and defending white-collar and organized crime cases, bolstering the team under District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. that is examining Mr. Trump and his family business, the Trump Organization. So to answer your question, yes.
So that
I think Georgia is out for blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Letitia James in the Attorney General's office is – there are and the Klan case that just got brought, the other civil actions that could be brought in a court that doesn't need 17 cowardly Republicans to convict them. Yeah, he said it himself today. He was like, they're going to sue me every day for the rest of my life. So that is the wild card in the whole thing.
And a lot of that $300 million is going to go to that.
Go to the legal fees.
Yes.
He's not stupid. He's got a $500 million of debt coming due in the next 3 years and $1.1 billion in the next 5 to 7. You're going to see a lot of Trump properties get sold and razed to the ground over the course of the next 4 or 5 years.
Well, maybe that's what provides a little bit of hope at this time.
I think it's reasonable. It's really the federal government was never going to be the one to do this, but the state government, the various state governments that have a dog in this hunt appear more than willing to. And I think for, you got to give the Biden administration credit. They didn't make Preet Bharara the attorney general like I was hoping, but they can certainly avail these state governments all the help that they can provide without necessarily turning it into the hood ornament for their administration, which they don't want to do because they don't want Trump to be in charge of their, you know, the conversation anymore. And I, to a degree, understand that sentiment.
Will, it's been fantastic talking with you. Really, really appreciate your expertise on these domestic political crises of various flavors here that we've been talking about this evening.
It's a privilege to be here.
William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist at Truthout, New York Times and internationally best-selling author of several books, and I think one of the most important domestic political analysts writing in this country today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the program. Will, thanks again.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Critical Conversations is produced at KPTZ Port Townsend. Comments are welcome and should be sent to contactus@kptz.org. Music is from 1960 What by Gregory Porter.